We cannot spoil our children with too much love or affection or attention. So ignoring bad behavior, that's old news, old news. We, by giving them attention, we cannot spoil them. By co-regulating them and giving them empathy and connection and soothing, we absolutely cannot spoil them. And in fact, when we do those things, it gives their brain practice going from dysregulated states back into regulated states. And that's how they learn to self-soothe, is by us doing that for them.
Welcome to the SensoryWise Solutions podcast for parents, where parents can get real, actionable strategies to support kids with sensory processing disorder. I'm Laura, OT and mom to Liliana, a sensory sensitive kid who inherited my anxiety and my love for all things Disney. Consider me your new OT mom bestie. I know my stuff, but I also know what it's really like in the trenches of parenting a child with sensory processing disorder.
Okay, mom, enough about me. Let's start the podcast.
Happy Occupational Therapy Month, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. This month, April 2022, we are celebrating the field of occupational therapy. And all of this month on Instagram and here on the podcast, I'm sharing all of the insights and tips and just the benefits that OT can provide for you and your family and your child. And I'm sharing this myself, but I am also sharing this through the lens of other professionals, other childhood development experts. And today I get to bring to you an interview with one of the queens of handling discipline, and that is Dr. Tina Payne Bryson. If you don't know her, she is the author of The Bottom Line for Baby and co-author with Dan Siegel of two New York Times bestsellers, The Whole Brain Child and No Drama Discipline, each of which has been translated into over 50 languages, as well as The Yes Brain and The Power of Showing Up. She's the founder and executive director of the Center for Connection, a multidisciplinary clinical practice in Southern California. You're going to hear us talk a little bit about this in the episode. And Dr. Bryson also keynotes conferences and conducts workshops for parents, educators, clinicians all over the world. And she frequently consults with schools, businesses, and other organizations. She is a super busy woman. And LCSW, Tina is a graduate of Baylor University with a PhD from USC. And the most important part of her life and her bio, she says, is that she's a mom to her three boys. And you can learn more about Dr. Bryson at tinabryson.com and also on Instagram at Tina Payne Bryson. All right, let's jump right in. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm so excited. You could probably hear in my voice how big I'm smiling to get the opportunity to talk to Dr. Tina Payne Bryson. Welcome, Dr. Bryson. I'm so happy to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. Please call me Tina.
Okay, perfect. Tina. Okay. So Tina is here today. You're listening to this episode in April. We are celebrating Occupational Therapy Month, and occupational therapy has been around since 1917, so quite some time, but it's still such a hidden field. I feel like no one really hears about it. No one really knows what it is. So every year, Occupational Therapy Month, I go all out, and the goal is to get as many people to learn about OT and all of the fabulous things that it does. But I'm here recruiting other professionals like Tina here so that I'm not the only one, the biased one, praising OT. I love to hear how other professionals work with OT, how they are impacted by OT. I feel like OT and psychology, like just being in therapy, I feel like these are the two things that everyone could benefit from. There's so many times when I will explain what OT does with kids and someone's like, well, I could benefit from that. I'm like, yeah, OT is amazing. And same thing with therapy. When I'm like, I talked to my therapist about this and someone's like, maybe I need a therapist. I'm like, honestly, everyone should just have a therapist. So it's one of those things, but there are definitely some people who benefit from OT services more than others or might need a little bit more support. So today we're going to talk about that, and on a very specific topic about bedtime battles, bedtime routines, and Tina is going to share with us some strategies to help you with those nighttime battles. But then we're also going to spend some time focusing on how you might adapt that or how it might look different when you have a neurodivergent child, because I know a lot of people listening have a child who is neurodivergent. So before we jump into that topic, Tina, I really want to hear about your center in Pasadena. I know you have OT services there, but can you just tell us about your center and what, and everything that it offers?
Yes, I'm a huge, huge OT fan. And in fact, I've sort of felt like I'm like if I could get another doctoral degree, I would probably get it in OT. I love it so much, you know, and I try to learn about as much of it as I can. And for a long time, for probably 10 or 15 years now, anytime I've ever spoken at a mental health conference or I'm speaking to educators or parents, I always talk about OT. And here's why. So I'm back in the day when I was a green therapist and I was doing therapy with kids, I also had been taught a lot about the brain and the nervous system. And so I think very differently when it comes to mental health stuff than a lot of how I was trained, because I did this additional training around interpersonal neurobiology. So here I am, this young green therapist. I've got a handful of kids on my caseload. It seemed like most of them were third and fourth grade kids with significant anxiety, debilitating anxiety. And so, you know, I kind of work through my lens and I start asking all of these questions to try to understand, like, what, you know, what is happening here? And so the way I think about anxiety is that the nervous system is really detecting some sort of threat or some sort of overwhelm, like where they can't regulate their states of arousal because they're in a heightened state of arousal because there's something that's giving them the signal of threat. So as a mental health person, I started asking all kinds of questions around that. And when it turned out that a huge number of the kids in my caseload had really safe, protective parental relationships where their parents did do a good job of regulating their stress states instead of amplifying them. They had warm, fuzzy teachers who were really lovely. They weren't being bullied at school. They didn't have a trauma history. And like, there was all this stuff. I'm like, why are these kids having a threat response when everything it looks like on the outside looks really safe? I'm confused about this. And so I said, I need to peel the layers back. I mean, I can work with them on their anxiety, but I don't want to just treat symptoms. I want to peel the layers back to say, what's causing the symptom? I mean, to give just an analogy, if I start coughing and I just keep taking cough medicine to stop myself from coughing, just cough suppressant, I may end up continuing to cough and cough and cough. But if I go to my doctor and my doctor says, oh, you have allergies, you need an allergy pill, or you actually have pneumonia, you need an antibiotic, or whatever it is, like, if we can get to the source instead of just treating the symptoms, we're just creating so many benefits. So as I started asking better questions and peeling the layers back, I came across the field of occupational therapy. And what it turned out was that about 85% of the kids who I was seeing for mood disorder kind of stuff that looked like mood disorder kind of stuff turned out to be kids who either had sensory processing challenges or some sort of sensory integration challenge, or they had some sort of underlying learning challenge that hadn't yet been discovered. They were neurodiverse kiddos. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I could give them some mental health strategies and teach them some top-down, you know, ways to use some strategies and some bottom-up ones with breathing and movement and all of these things. But what these kids really needed was OT or a neuropsych assessment and an educational therapist. So all of that inspired me to say, if we truly are going to chase the why, which is really the whole kind of approach in no drama discipline too, I need professionals around me that know things I don't, that can ask better questions. And so much of the time, it's not simple. The brain is complex. The nervous system is complex. So I wanted a place. So I created the Center for Connection that is multidisciplinary. So it's mental health and neuropsychological assessment across the lifespan. And then we also have occupational therapy, educational therapy, and speech and language pathology. And I wish we also had psychiatry and developmental pediatrician and all of that. But, you know, we're only 6 years old and we're still learning and growing. But we started with a handful of people that had been in my study group to learn about interpersonal neurobiology from various fields. And now we have about 50 people who work for us. And we have big, long wait list. So it's a model that people are really excited about. And we create specific carved out time for our teams to interact with each other so that we can ask better questions. And we don't want to work outside of our scope of practice, but we want to be interdisciplinary practitioners. And the longer we work with other people, the better we can do that.
Yeah, that's the one thing that I was also looking for as an OT is I love collaborating with other OTs, but there's so many times when I'm like, oh, this kid might really, really benefit from a play therapist or from a psychological lens or from this lens. And then I will send a parent that route and then come back. And it just feels like everyone's on this goose chase. Like, how great would it be to just go down the hall and be like, hey, what do you think about this? Do you think we should try this? Like, that's amazing to have all that in one place.
It gives us the benefit too. Like, I remember when we first started, we had a kid who was, who I would say even had educational trauma. He was, he had really significant learning challenges and his repeated experiences in school were pretty terrible. And his nervous system got really jacked up when it came time to sit and learn. So what we did was we actually, so he had a full, you know, neuropsychological evaluation. We were able to discover what his learning challenges were and his strengths. He had some amazing strengths too. Kids always do. And we want to look for those. And then we had our occupational therapist do a full assessment as well. And the two of them could then work together. And what was amazing is so the parent, it was like an hour long session, right? And the parent was paying for an hour session. But what we did was this kid who really didn't get much learning done in an hour of educational therapy, instead spent 25 minutes or so in OT. And the occupational therapist would give him the kinds of sensory inputs that would help him regulate his nervous system, feel safe in his body, be resourced. And then he would spend like 20 or 25 minutes in educational therapy. And he would learn so much in those 20 to 25 minutes. But more importantly than what he was learning was that he was having an experience of learning and being a student and creating a new self-concept of himself in a state in his body and in terms of what his experience was that was positive. So it was like starting to rewire who he was or how he felt about himself as a learner. So I think some really powerful things can come. I know our speech and language pathologists and our OTs do a lot of amazing work together as well, because a lot of times kids do have social communication challenges that are also connected to emotional regulation, that are also connected to attentional regulation, which OTs are really savvy and skilled at helping through sensory experiences. So I love it. And we just, it's such a rich environment. Parents feel really held because they don't have to run around from place to place to place. And they know that it's kind of a similar lens where we really celebrate parents and say, you know, we're not the professionals who are going to do stuff to your kid and then you're going to take them home. Like, you're the expert of your child. You are as important part of the team. And it's pretty exciting.
Are you able to, do you have a way where it's kind of when you're evaluating a child where all the professionals can like kind of see at once and overlap rather than like one by one evaluation? And then from there be like, okay, I'm going to assess this as the OT and the speech. Oh, I saw kind of this. I'm going to look at that. Does that kind of lend itself? Yes.
So yeah, I think, you know, it depends on what a family's time and resources and desires and openness are. So, you know, we have to always kind of play that. One of the ways we think about this is, let's say the first point person is like the neuropsychologist who's doing like a full evaluation, and our people are trained to do some sensory screenings and things like that. We may say, okay, look, you can kind of think about this person as like your general practitioner, but just like when you go to your general practitioner and they say, hey, I think you also should see the cardiologist or you should also see the endocrinologist, right? Mm-hmm. So that's often the kind of starting point. All the family knows is that their kid's getting kicked out of school, the behavior's out of control at home, they're desperate, they don't know what's going on. And so we often start, I mean, our team is pretty savvy now at saying, let's start with OT or
so right. But their first point of entry is typically like a behavior at school or at home that's kind of gotten out of hand.
Yeah. And where parents are feeling really overwhelmed or not sure, or they're afraid. They're really afraid that something's really wrong with their kid. And I, you know, I always like to reframe that as, look, one of the ways we can think about that is, what are the demands of a particular situation? What is your child's capacity? And if those are, you know, obviously our demand, the demands are always shifting and our capacity is always shifting. If in general, they're a pretty good match, we do pretty well. But when the demands of the situation and our capacity are, there's a huge gap there, that's where we're going to see anxiety, depression, acting out behaviors, internalizing behaviors, Things that look like what some people label oppositional defiant disorder, which I am not, I never will give that diagnosis. And I will always ungive that diagnosis because oppositional behavior is communication that something is not working and we can peel it back and figure out what that is and then treat that. So I think, so often they're sort of seen that way. So for some families, they're like, we want, we don't ever want to do more than a family needs because that's wasteful of their resources and time. But when it's clear, the problems have been going on a long time, we get information from the family, we get information from the school, and it looks like there's a lot happening, then yes, we can have all of those professionals working together and do a full comprehensive evaluation. Otherwise, we can do it stepwise where that information is shared along the way so that parents aren't having to tell their story over and over and over again.
Yeah. So I want to know, what are some of, if a child came to you first or to an educational specialist or a neuropsychologist, what are some of your most common signs that you would be like, oh, OT would be a perfect first stop for you? What are some of the most common cases that you find that you direct straight to OT?
I work in a school as well. So I do a lot of consulting in lots of different schools. And, some of the cases are really obvious, kids who are removing clothing articles, way past the age where we would expect that, lots of sensory seeking kinds of behaviors, which some people might think of as like ADHD hyperactivity. And as you know, there's like a 50% comorbidity around attentional regulation challenges and sensory challenges. But I think, sometimes they're really obvious. Kids covering their ears. I'll tell you like one that felt really obvious to me. I don't know that it would be to everyone, but this one little girl, she was seen as ODD, oppositional defiant disorder. And she was very oppositional and she was not cooperative. She would stomp everywhere she went. She would climb under her desk and curl up in a ball and refuse to participate. The way that we create meaning around those behaviors makes every bit of difference about what happens next, right? And we have to remember that as parents, as professionals, as educators, we are meaning makers for our children in how we perceive those behaviors. So for me, this looked like she was over responsive in terms of stimuli. I know I feel like I'm talking about your profession now.
I love it.
Really overwhelmed by sound and by smell. And she was obvious about it. She would cover her ears. She would cover her nose. She would run away from other kids. And then she was also under responsive about other kinds of things, stomping on the ground, needing to like push up against the wall. So to me, that felt really obvious that OT was the starting place. But a lot of times it's not that obvious. And what people don't understand and why I love OT so much is, all of the things that we do that lead us to the place of being able to regulate our attention and to regulate our bodies and to regulate our emotions and to direct our behavior and to communicate with other people, like all of these things seem like mental health kinds of things. And they are, but they are also foundationally built upon how our sensory systems process information. So for me, if someone comes to me and the behaviors are really big, I'm going to start peeling back the layers and I'm going to ask questions about daily activities. What is getting dressed like? What is eating like? What are the battles you have the most? The questions I kind of love to ask parents are like, what do you fight the most with your kids about? Mm-hmm. What are the most battle? What's the most frequent battle? I ask a lot of questions about daily routines. And that often gives us a lot of information about kids trying to make sense of their world. Like, let me give you a really specific example. This is actually a really funny story. I had this family come to me. The little boy was 5. And his older brother was already in school. So he had been on the campus of the school multiple times taking his older brother. And it was time for him to start kindergarten. And before kindergarten started, they had like a pre-K, like a summer kind of get ready for kinder kind of program. And the parents started taking him, thinking this will be great. He's going to love it. And he started just freaking out every time the mom would try to drop him off. He got so highly distressed that he would like bite her or rip her clothes and cling, like he wouldn't let her leave. And so I always ask parents, I start with, what's your theory about that behavior? Like, what do you think of that? And mom's theory and her husband agreed that he was manipulating. She was like, he's just manipulating us. And I'm like, what's he manipulating you for? Like, to do? What is he you think he's trying to get? Well, he just wants to stay home with me. And I said, well, why would he, you know, tell me more about that? And as we began to explore, the parents' theory around this was that he was, you know, he was just manipulating them. And so I began to ask more questions. Well, have you, this looks like something we call separation anxiety. And that when you're with him, you are his best strategy to regulate him. And so when you're there, he feels safe and he can tolerate whatever's happening around him. But when you are going to leave, he panics because you're his best tool and he doesn't feel like he can regulate. So I think there's a big response there. Have you ever seen this before? No, they had never seen separation anxiety before. He had been at a previous preschool and never had seen this. He had not, you know, not really that much with babysitters. He might cry, but it wasn't this kind of a response. And so I began to be curious. This is the most important thing any of us can do when we see behaviors in our kids and as professionals, like we're trying to figure it out, be curious. So I said, I wonder why, you know, this would be like this. So I started asking questions. The last preschool was like 10 to 12 kids, two teachers, tiny little environment, tiny little playground. The new program, he had to make like 5 transitions. There were 100 kids he was eating lunch with. And so I was like, wow, I wonder if that's too much input for his little system, right? And it turned out this kid had all kinds of sensory things. I sent them to get an OT evaluation. But what ended up happening, like here's an everyday example. The dad and the son would get into these massive battles. Like the son would be like, I want the blue cup. And he'd be like, the blue cup's in the dishwasher. You can't have it. And he would just freak out to where he became violent. And then his dad would get really angry and, you know, and like try to grab him so that he couldn't hit him and then say, you got to go to your room. And then the kid wouldn't stay in his room. So the dad's holding the door and the kid's like destroying his room. And this was multiple times a day. And so when they came to me, you know, they thought he was spoiled and that he needed stricter discipline. And as we began to explore this, I was like, well, what have you tried? Have you tried strict discipline? And they were like, yeah, I guess that's what we've been doing. And I'm like, okay, well, let's be a little more curious. Let's look at this. And so once we finally figured out that he did have some sensory things, you know, him demanding that blue cup was about him trying to make his world work for him. There was something about that blue cup that felt better on his mouth or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think if our kids have confusing behaviors to us that seem much more dramatic than what we would expect developmentally. Like it's normal for a 3-year-old to throw a tantrum when we cut their muffin in half and we can't put it back together like they ask, right? But one thing that I think is a really important clue that might cue you into saying, you know what, I'm going to call an OT and just ask some questions. See, is this right for me? If your child has multiple tantrums throughout the day that last more than about 20 minutes or so. And that's a frequent thing. They go on longer than 20 minutes, multiple times a day, day after day. That to me is a cue that the nervous system is having something that is taxing it in a way that I would want to be curious about.
Yep. Yeah. That's 20 minute marker is usually, and I haven't found like literature that like defines like this is the point, but like from my experience as a mom with a neurodivergent kid and the clients that I see, like when I hear someone's like, oh, we had a terrible tantrum this morning, it was like a whole 5 minutes, I'm like, okay. I'm like, okay. So that kind of gives me, I do kind of start with like the timing, but then also like you said, how OTs always think is, how does this impact you daily? Oh, well, we've been late to school every day this week. Right. We had to cancel this appointment. We can't hang out with friends. We can't go to the restaurant. Like that is extremely impactful on your daily life. And what I want to go back to what you mentioned about OT too, that I love is that OTs are really good at examining the environment and like the most subtle things that could be setting off a child that a parent like, I didn't even think of that. Yeah. And I'm like, it sounds like every time in that corner, there's something going on over there. Oh, well, it's because the reflection of the light and there's something there. Or there's so many little things that a lot of OTs take into consideration. And also, so we help find out the underlying reasons for the behavior based on environment. But that means then we can also
adapt the environment to help decrease that gap, like you were talking about, between the demands and the capacity. So we're not always just trying to fix or change or do something to the child. Yes, we want to support them and give them the skills. But if we can adapt the environment and the tasks so that that comes down and then it's already easier for the child, then that's, you know, that's one of the best ways that you can help in the moment right then, and then build those skills in therapy along the side.
And that's the case for anything. I mean, I feel like, you know, that's how I think about psychotherapy that I do, you know, that I do, but, you know, or educational therapy or speech and language or whatever. It's really, we sort of get really clear about what that gap is. And then we get curious, like, how big is the gap, right? So we look at duration, intensity, frequency of these kinds of behaviors. Then we go, okay, what is the gap about? Let's get curious about that. And then it's so helpful. The magic sauce is we bring down the demands as we build the skill so that it's a match. Mm-hmm. And then when that, then as that happens, their capacity, as their capacity expands, the demands can also expand. So this is not about like bending the whole world to our child and keeping it that way forever, because I know parents get really afraid that the world won't be like that. But we need to tell parents, trust development, your child's no matter what your child is like, we all have individual differences. You know, if there's neurodiversity present, if there's not neurodiversity present, it none of those things matter around this point. It really is the idea that even if we don't do anything, as the brain develops and as development unfolds, our child's capacity to tolerate things or their window of tolerance gets wider anyway. But if while their brain is plastic, we can provide these kinds of inputs, it can be incredibly powerful to expand that window now, which gives them more opportunities earlier while they have, you know, then they can learn more and they can be in a more regulated state in their body, which then allows them to be curious and to explore as opposed to being in a defensive survive mode. I think the other thing too, is when you said like, if there's little things sometimes we miss that it would never occur to us. I think back to this idea of curiosity, we make assumptions about children far too often. Well, we do it about everything. We sort of have this arrogance about us where we assume we think we know what it is. But usually we're wrong, you know? So like, for example, I had a mom who came to me, it was also a separation anxiety preschool situation. And she said, you know, he's never had separation anxiety before. And I'm just, you know, I don't really know what this is, but he's just having a really hard time with the goodbyes in the morning. And I said, have you ever asked him, he was like four, have you ever asked him, what's the hardest part about the goodbye? And what was funny was, she was wrong. It wasn't separation anxiety at all. He said, my teacher squeezes me too hard and her voice is too loud when she says hello in the mornings. Okay. This is a sensory preference that was super easy to fix, right? So she gave him the option. She said, hugs are too tight. Do you want a really gentle hug or do you want a fist bump or a high five, or you want to bump elbows? Like, what would you like? So she just, and she turned her volume down. And once she did those two things, the goodbye was easy. It wasn't at all about separation anxiety with mom. So I think we have to ask our kids. Yeah. And we also have to keep in mind though, that sometimes they don't know, you know, we ask like,
what, or they're non-speaking, right?
Or they're nonverbal. Right. Yeah. So in this way, it's also connected to our attachment with them, which is really about tuning in, reading cues, coming with curiosity, instead of making assumptions, and really tracking what our kids are communicating, whether it's through words or not.
I that's one of the first things I tell parents too, when they're saying, I can't figure out, I'm like, well, have you asked? And they're like, well, no, I don't think he would know. And I was like, maybe he would, might as well ask. My daughter did the same thing where she was starting to get really stuck on having her hair the same way every single day. And I was like, oh gosh, here, because her triggers and her things that I've been tracking is like, it's kind of like sounding OCD type, and she's very rigid. So I'm like, oh gosh, here's another thing she's obsessed with, being the same. And I finally asked, I'm like, how come you don't like doing pigtails anymore? We used to do pigtails. We used to do this. Now you only want it in this half up, half down, very specific. Oh, well, after nap time, it always messes up my pigtails. And then my teachers won't help me tighten it. And I don't like the way that it feels. And I'm like, oh my gosh. Like,
I had no idea.
Yeah. Right. So now let's apply this and keep this conversation, what we're going to talk about today, with the bedtime battles, which is such a specific one. So I want to focus. I'm sure there are still older kids, maybe even teenagers, who still push back at bedtime. But let's focus today on that, like, maybe toddler preschool age, the under five crew, who are having daily bedtime battles, maybe leading up to bedtime, maybe during bath, after bath, that whole stretch that is so stressful in households everywhere. I want to hear from you. What are some of the most common struggles that you hear often? And then I also want to talk about some of your best strategies that you suggest to help bedtime routines go a little bit smoother for these parents. And then after that, just to give people a heads up of what we're talking about, then at the end, we'll narrow it down to how that looks different for neurodivergent children.
So I have three children, and I will say that I have had lots and lots and lots of practice doing it badly and doing it well. I think probably I would say the number one least pleasant part of parenting when my children were young was the sibling conflict. That was number one. And bedtime battles was number two. So I really feel for you parents, you're tired, they're tired. You just want them to get to bed so you can have 1 minute to pee by yourself once during the day. You know, it's really a lot. I understand. Here's one thing that's super important about anything. You can apply this to eating challenges or getting dressed challenges or anything, but keep in mind the brain is an association machine. So if we make bedtime unpleasant and stressful and we're yelling at them and we're rushing them and consistently, like for sure we'll have nights like everything I just said, like I've done it. But in general, what is the typical experience around bedtime? If it's stressful, if it's rushed, if parents yelling and unhappy with them, if there's a lot of conflict, of course they're going to push against it and have dreaded, you know, feelings of dread leading up to it and be oppositional around it and uncooperative because, you know, like, I don't want to go to an unpleasant dental appointment, right? Like I'm going to, and so they come into bedtime with all kinds of negativity bias if it's typically an unpleasant experience. Now, rest assured, history is not destiny, no matter what your bedtimes have looked like up until this moment. The brain and the associations we make and our memory systems are based on repeated experiences. So you can start creating positive associations with bedtime right now, and your child will adapt to that quickly. So we want to make it pleasant and safe and cozy and delightful and something your child, even though they may not want to stop what they're doing because the day is amazing and they're programmed to learn and grow and explore, that they still want to do it. So a couple of things, and I actually learned this tip from an OT, the lead OT on my team a number of years ago, is, and particularly for neurodiverse kids who might have specific sensory aversions around certain things like putting on pajamas or brushing teeth or things like that, to do the most unpleasant or the most offensive one first when your child is more regulated, right? Less tired. And then you have all the good things. So some of the ways I tried to create, obviously honoring your child's individual preferences, some kids might not want to be snuggled, or they might want touch in a way that's pleasant and not what you might think of. But any chance of like connection and coziness and cuddling. I used to have my sons, I'm thinking about my latest one, more recent bedtimes, but I would say, okay, what do you need to do? What's your job? You know, and he'd say pajamas, brush your teeth, you know, whatever. We'd hit all those. And I would say, okay, as soon as those are done, we're going to play Uno. And we did. And he was super excited. And an Uno game would last 5 minutes, you know, but he would, there was a game or something fun we were doing. So he would do the other stuff with the anticipation of something fun about to happen. And so that helped with a lot of cooperation. But keep in mind, if we're like, go to sleep, and we're screaming at them, yeah, like it's really hard for them to do that.
Can I ask you then if, so this is leading into the discipline part a little bit. So then if you are having one of those nights where even if they have something fun to expect, but they don't get things done in time or they're still refusing, is it a fair thing to say, well, now we don't have time to play Uno? And then that becomes like a punishment almost, unless it's more of a logical consequence. How would you react to that?
I think we have to keep in mind, our goal is to help them go to sleep, right? And so sometimes, like, I'll tell you about a bedtime battle. My son was about 8, and the older brothers, I'm really militant about sleep in my house. And it's probably the only thing I'm militant about. But I mean, I have lots of boundaries and expectations, because boundaries, expectations, limits are really great for kids. They help them feel safe. So I don't mean to say that I'm permissive. I'm absolutely not. But the thing I'm like really rigid about is bedtime. Mm-hmm. So, or getting enough sleep. So the older brothers are having friends over. It's a Friday night. They're preteen and teen, and he's like 8 or 9, and it's time to read. And he is so mad that the brothers get to stay up and he doesn't. So he's like flopping around like a fish out of water, out of his anger. He's just like furious, furious, furious. Now, I want in that moment to say, okay, if you're going to do that, then I'm not going to read. Or, okay, now you've had this, you know, tantrum all this time. So now we only have time to read one book, or now we can't play Uno.
Oh my God. I've said that before. I'm cringing. Me too.
You hear how easily it comes out of my mouth.
Yeah.
The problem with that is, okay, first of all, and this is a whole other thing, but behavior is communication about what skills need to be built. So he's basically saying, hey, mom, I'm not yet in the place in development where I'm able to handle like when things feel unfair and I'm not getting what I want to happen when I'm dysregulated. Like, I don't know how to do that yet. Right. If I threaten him and remove something, when he's in a reactive state, he's not going to learn that. The brain is either in a receptive state where it can learn, or it's in a reactive state where it cannot learn. The whole point and purpose of discipline is for our children to become self-disciplined people. The way we get them there is through learning. He cannot learn in this moment. So if I say, okay, now, you know, this is what happens. You lose it. Next time, maybe you'll do better. It doesn't really work that way, that cleanly, because when our kids are regulated, they typically are fairly cooperative, right? So he's in this dysregulated state. If I just threaten to remove all this stuff, he's not going to learn anything. Number one, people are really confused about that. You know, people think, no, you have to do it so they won't learn. That's not how they learn. That's based on really old animal research from the 50s. The other thing is, it's going to be a lose-lose, because he's going to get more upset, and his job is to down-regulate, to fall asleep. And if I threaten him and leave the room and take things away, it's counterproductive. It's so much better for me to say, and it's fine if you hold a limit. Like, I can say, if that's true and it's getting really late, it's fine for me to say, oh, sweetie, we really don't have time to do Uno tonight. Tomorrow, we're going to play 2 games. We'll play one, you know, earlier in the day. And if he cries and he's upset about not getting to play, you know, that's okay. Right. And then my job is to walk with him through it and be like, I know that's so disappointing. And I'm right here with you while you're disappointed.
Versus just being like, well, now we can't play Uno, but just the way you deliver it can still be a moment of connection and still helping them downregulate, even with those big emotions before bed.
And I think, and this leads to like my second tip, is around using playfulness, silliness, and this helps with cooperation. So let's say I really am worried about the time. It's getting really late. I might give a choice. I might say, we can either play Uno and only read 2 books instead of 4, or we can read 4 books and play a game of Uno tomorrow. So I might do that. But I also might say, okay, instead of our regular Uno game tonight, so I'm not even going to be like, I'm taking away the Uno, whatever. Instead of our regular game of Uno tonight, I'm going to give you half the deck, and I'm going to take the other half. And we're going to flip the cards over as fast as we can and see who's going to win. Ready? Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's going to happen. That's going to take less than 1 minute.
Right.
And then, and say, we're going to do this. And so we're going to do this instead of our regular game, but this is going to be called Speed Uno Flash Style. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Makes
sense. Yeah.
So we bring in that kind of playfulness and silliness. And I think, you know, yes, we have to be careful about not amplifying what's happening, because we want to downregulate them. But if I'm not creative there, he's going to get upregulated anyway, because he's not going to get to play and he's going to get really upset. So if we bring in this silliness and this play, it can elicit a cooperation, like around toothbrushing. Like, maybe my kids like doesn't want to brush their teeth. I can say, okay, I'm so glad you're not going to brush your teeth tonight, because I'm going to use your toothbrush and I might clean out all the cobwebs, but I'm saying it in a funny, silly way. Now, obviously, if that's going to upset your kid, don't do that. This is if your kid is at the age of development and can handle this. Or you say, okay, here's what we're going to do tonight. You're going to brush your teeth and I have to make up a rhyming song about brushing dog's teeth. I don't know. You just come up with something. But anytime, or I talk about in the Whole Brain Child, we talk about the getting dressed game where you have your child, okay, put your pajama top on and then I'm going to tell you what to do. So they put their pajama top on and you say, okay, now we're going to hug your teddy bear as hard as we can. So go grab it, you know, and then come back. So they go hug the teddy bear. They come back. Okay. Now we're putting on the pajama bottoms. Okay. Then what's going to happen? You know, and then they put their pajama bottoms on and you're like, now we're going to reach up and we're going to try and tickle the ceiling for a count of five, you know, and you're having them stretch, you know? Mm-hmm. So we can do different things that make it fun. Again, we're creating these positive associations through play and playfulness and those kinds of things.
Yeah, I love that because then you're getting them some movement, stretching, but more down-regulated. I want to insert myself here a little bit. The OT is coming out because I hear a lot of parent coaches talk about things to do before bedtimes for kids who are resistant to bedtime, maybe more active around bedtime. And so they're like, oh, jump on the trampoline or do spins or do like wrestling before bed because they're thinking of getting like sensory input. But the OT brain in me like screams. I'm like, but not all kids will respond well to this, especially even if you have a sensory seeker, sometimes that kind of like high energy sensory input right before bed is just going to completely backfire. So how Tina says it, the down regulating, you still want to provide them like heavy work and deep input, but through more isolated like massage, hand squeezes, squeezing a bear, like she said, rather than like really high intensity. You want to do those kind of movement activities earlier, way earlier, like before bath time or however long you're doing. Not right in the last, I would even say hour before bed. That would ramp up a lot of kids. So I love that you talked about that. What I always remind parents, and I have to remind myself this because there are some nights where I'm like, I don't want to perform. Like, I feel like I'm performing for her. I don't have the energy. I'm not in the mood, but I have to remember. And sometimes I don't, but when I do, I remember I can either spend my energy doing this, connecting with her, building a positive association, doing this game that I really don't want to do right now because I've done this all day as an OT, or I'm just not in the mood. Or I could spend the energy fighting with her about getting her in bed and then being pissed off for the hour that she's already in bed and like not like, and it's, I'm ruminating in my brain. So I'm like, either way, I'm spending extra energy tonight that I don't want to, but this energy that I'll be spending is much more beneficial to our relationship into the night. But that's something that I have to remind parents because you're right. So hard.
I had a mom one time say, so I was telling her about using playfulness and silliness to elicit cooperation. And she was like, I don't want to do an effing puppet show to get her shoes on. And I said, I know, but think about the energy you're going to put in the battle otherwise, you know?
Either way, it's going to be, it's not a snap of the finger. It's not a snap of the finger. And that's sometimes there's some, a lot of work that needs to be done internally for parents to really get that mindset shift to understand that maybe your child does need a lot of extra support around bedtime. And that's just the way it is maybe in this stage, in this phase. And I know it sucks. And so parents also need that validation that you're right. This does suck that you have to do it. And your neighbor next door can just snap a finger and their kid is in bed. I'm sorry. You know, like there's that part.
Kids are so different. And so, you know, if you're one of your kids is really easy to sleep and another one isn't, like that doesn't mean there's something wrong with your kid or that you're doing something wrong. And please don't compare your kids to other people's kids either. I think, you know, think about what is so pleasant to you. Like, you know, think about like when you're in love, like when you're totally like a dopamine poisoning in love and you just want to be with that person every second. And it feels so good to be with that person. And it's all you want to do. That's often kind of how our kids feel about us when they're really little and we're reading stories to them and they want us to stay in their rooms as they fall asleep because it feels so good to them. And so, you know, I think there's also a lot of messaging in our society, like, you know, you shouldn't let kids sleep with you or you shouldn't stay in their rooms as they're falling asleep and they have to learn to self-soothe and all that stuff. Honestly, like I've never once in all my years have seen a kid who slept in their parents' bed or where the parents helped them stay in the room while they fell asleep, that as teenagers, they couldn't fall asleep on their own and had to sleep with their parents. Like I've never once seen it. We really don't have to worry about that. I think that's another big discipline concept. And there's decades and decades and decades of literature to support what I'm going to say here. And that is that We cannot, the society is wrong about this. We cannot spoil our children with too much love or affection or attention. So ignoring bad behavior, that's old news, old news. We, by giving them attention, we cannot spoil them. By co-regulating them and giving them empathy and connection and soothing, we absolutely cannot spoil them. And in fact, when we do those things, it gives their brain practice going from dysregulated states back into regulated states. And that's how they learn to self-soothe, is by us doing that for them. We're spoiling, and I don't even like that word. I'm using air quotes so you can't see me. Where spoiling comes in is where parents don't set boundaries and limits and have expectations and structure. So we really want to be really high on expectations, limits, boundaries, but also be as high as we can on all that other stuff. And we're not going to spoil them. So you can't, if your child feels safer as they fall asleep and it takes a few minutes longer for you to stay in the room, scrolling through Instagram in the chair in the corner while they fall asleep, like, fine. It's like, great. Because what you're doing is you're creating an association with, I feel safe. Bedtime is, falling asleep is pleasant. So it's a really good investment of time.
Yeah. Would you consider a parent who has a boundary, like, okay, it's time to get in the bath, and then that's their bath, it's 5 minutes. A parent who extends the time, okay, fine, 5 more minutes. Does that count as spoiling or fall in that area of having no boundary if you can't follow through with it, or because you just, oh, fine, whatever, 5 more minutes, and you just have loosey-goosey?
Great question. It's a great question. So two things I want to say about that. One is, it's totally fine to give our kids 5 more minutes or one more story or whatever from time to time. Like, right? I mean, I'm like, I tell myself, like, I'm going to eat 2 cookies, and I'm like, all right, fine, I'm going to eat 4. Whatever. Right. Okay, so this is, it's fine. We can be flexible. We don't have to be rigid. But here's where it matters. The way we do it matters. So it's totally fine to even change our minds. Like, let's say I told my kid 5 more minutes, or you know, we're going to bed. And then he says, can I have 5 more minutes? In that moment, if I'm like, okay, fine, have 5 more minutes. That is not what I want to do. Instead, I can say, let me look. Yeah, we've got time. 5 more minutes is perfectly fine. And then the other thing I would say, and my kids learn this, is I think negotiating and, you know, making compromises, that is phenomenal prefrontal practice for our kids, because they have to think about what's going to appeal to us and how they should ask. And that's really good brain work. But as soon as I say, I'm not changing my mind. So if I say, you can have 5 more minutes, and then they ask for 5 more minutes, and I say, no, we've done 5 more minutes. We're not doing 5 more minutes. And they start crying, please, please, please. I say, we're not having 5 more minutes. We're going up right now, and I'm not changing my mind. Mm-hmm. Then I don't change my mind. And they know then that when I say that phrase, it's not worth continuing to go. So it's totally fine to do that. I think the other thing to keep in mind, though, like, remember my kid fish out of water flopping on the bed when it was time to go to sleep, when I was trying to read to him. What had happened there is he had asked for 15 more minutes to stay up with the brothers. And what happened was he was 15 minutes more tired for the battle that was going to be inevitable anyway. So at that moment, I probably should have just held the boundary and then it's okay again for him to be upset. We don't set the boundary early enough. So sometimes, like, if we let ourselves keep sliding further and further, we're really just setting ourselves up to not handle it well.
Okay, so I want to summarize the strategies that you mentioned and then do a quick little talk about the neurodivergent piece with this whole thing. So
let me just hit like 5 strategies to, like, let me just punch it here quickly. Yes.
Yeah.
Pleasant association machine, right? Make it pleasant. Number 2, use playfulness, silliness, not too amplified, to create more of that pleasantness, but also to help them, you know, cooperate. The 3rd one is to start early enough. When our children get tired, when we all get tired, in order to stay awake and continue to engage, our body has to release adrenaline, epinephrine, and cortisol to keep us awake. So if we wait too long to start the bedtime routine, they're actually going to be amped up even higher. So start early enough. That's really important. I know that's hard with family schedules, but as best you can, start early enough. Number 4, don't rush it. And I know sometimes you are going to have rush bedtimes. That's just the reality of family life. But if we give them time, think about one of the ways we can think about falling asleep is it's actually one of the hardest things our young children have to do to downregulate their nervous systems. So you can think about almost like their volume dial is up, and to fall asleep, their volume dial has to get turned all the way down. So that takes time. It takes time to transition and to downregulate. You know, just like I talked about tantrums that last more than like 20 minutes, there's a reason behind that. And that is that when there is an initial kind of reactivity that happens, you get mad, you get scared. It takes about 20 minutes for your HPA axis to release like all that adrenaline and cortisol and all of that. And for it to kind of move through your body, that takes, you know, 15 to 20 minutes. So if the tantrums are going longer and you're not able to return to baseline, there's a whole thing behind that. And I think that's the same thing with downregulating, is it takes time for us to turn that volume dial down. And the more we can emphasize safety and the feeling, felt sense of safety, a lot of kids have nighttime fears. And then when parents are like, you have to stay in your room, and if you come out, you're going to get in trouble. That leaves the child in an unresolvable biological paradox, which is either I go to my parent and I'm going to get in trouble and that feels terrible, or I have to stay in my room terrified and that feels terrible. Like, don't leave our kids in those kinds of states. If your child is truly afraid, this is not a behavior problem. This becomes for us a prompt. How do I cultivate a sense of safety? And that might mean me staying in the room until they get that, until they have that. It might mean having a light on. It might mean having music on. It might mean having a pet or a sibling in the room. It might mean all kinds of things, but what can cultivate your child's sense of safety? If you think about falling asleep, it's the most vulnerable time we have as sort of mammals. Like, if you think about people who lived out in the wild before we had houses and stuff, when you fell asleep, that was when you were most vulnerable to prey. So falling asleep is really an exercise, and we really have to feel safe to do that. The fifth one and the last one is, come up with something with your kid that can be really fun, especially if they're like 4 or 5 or older. Have them come up with a lullaby playlist, or you create one for them if they're too young to do that. And you might want to switch it out every now and then, or you can listen to some sort of mindfulness kind of thing. My son loved this beautiful, there was this one, I just found it on YouTube. It was free. And it was like a falling asleep. And this guy was like, it was like a guided visualization where they were like in a hot air balloon and they were crossing the plains. And what do you see? And he had he had an Australian accent, and I would like totally fall asleep listening to it too with him. But when you create playlists or you listen to some sort of mindfulness thing, it gives your child something to focus on. So they're not thinking about the fears as much. They're not thinking about, you know, worry thoughts or whatever. They're focusing on it as their body is as that volume dial is getting turned down. And then once they fall asleep to it several times, their brain has also made an association between that and going to sleep. So it actually almost becomes like lubricant for future sleep. So that's another tip we can use.
I love all of those. Those are all super actionable. So what I want to then segue into this last bit is talk about, you mentioned earlier, and we've been talking about this whole time, that, you know, the brain creates, it's an association machine, right? The neurons that fire together, wired together, the more experiences you have that are similar within the same context will create like this pathway in your brain that's like, oh, I've done this before, and this is my stress pathway. I'm just going to go straight into triggered mode because it creates a shortcut to meltdown or tantrum or this fight or flight mode. So what I always tell parents is that when you have a child with sensory processing challenges, particularly sensory sensitivities, which is usually the bigger player for bedtime routine because of bath time, sounds in the bathroom, grooming, brushing hair, lotions, mm-hmm. all of the things, PJs, all of that is sensory sensitive. What I educate parents on and tell them is sometimes these things start out as a sensory trigger, a pure sensory trigger that is painful on my body, that is painful for my ears. I can't focus. It's too much. I'm overstimulated. What once may have started like that when they were really young, the more often they have that kind of association because you have to do it every day, then morphs into this like anxiety and like learned fear. And we need to start there to, I call it like decreasing the scare factor or undoing the scare factor of bedtime routine. But so if all of these strategies aren't working, that might be a sign that an OT might come in and help and really look at the context, the environment, and try to pinpoint maybe it's the bath time, the sound of the running water in your echoey bathroom is triggering them. And now their brain has associated that. So they're not only, they used to only cry in the bathroom, but now their brain has become so efficient that it's going to start crying and avoiding the bath time right after dinner. And it just extends and extends. And so we need to create those positive associations, which OTs often talk about the just right challenge. So yep. I always talk about playing in the bathroom outside of bath time to create fun, positive experiences so the brain can start unlearning the scare, the pathway, building new pathways to regulation around bath time. So OTs can really help pinpoint which part of bedtime routine is it? Is it the separation anxiety about bedtime, or is it the PJs, or is it the tipping your head back when you have to rinse off the shampoo because your vestibular system is over responsive? There's so many subtle things that you can start with, but we pinpoint that and then work on that in OT while also giving parents education on why it's hard. And that insight goes a long way for just the compassion and like, oh my gosh, that makes so much sense. I had no idea. I thought it was he didn't like water on his face, but it was the tipping his head back that was really hard for him. Right. So that stuff happens a lot. So I want to ask you then, if at that point, when you work with parents through bedtime routine and then you they work with OT on those longer term skills. How do you, or are there any other extra tips that you give parents of neurodivergent kids in the moment for like while they're still going through therapy, but they haven't quite built those skills yet? Are there any extra things that you suggest to them? Or is it kind of just like a trust the process, you'll get there one day type of thing?
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite phrases that applies to all of us, no matter where our kids are, is to trust development. And to trust the process. I think that's a really important part. I think, you know, for me, anytime I'm really worried about something with one of my boys or whatever, if I pause and ask myself, like, is it better now than it was 6 months ago? Or is he better at being able to do this than he was a year ago? If the answer is yes, I'm like, okay, I'm gonna trust development. If the answer is no, that's a really good indicator. I need some support. You know, we need to figure out what's going on. The thing I would say around the sort of additional thing to think about is I think applicable to everybody, but even more so with neurodiverse kids. And that is this, and this is kind of the main point of my book, The Power of Showing Up, that I wrote with Jan Siegel, is that one of the best predictors for how we turn out on everything we measure kids on is that they have secure attachment with at least one person. And by the way, that's not at all attachment parenting. I'm not talking about attachment parenting. This is a totally separate deal. And so Dan and I say, how do we cultivate that? How do we cultivate secure attachment if it's one of the most important things we can do for our children, no matter if they're neurodiverse or neurotypical? And really, Dan and I talk about the four S's. And for me, this is my North Star. So no matter what's happening with my kid or with any kid in the moment, if I'm the therapist or I'm coaching another parent for their neurodiverse kid, if I can give the four S's as my response, it's always the best response. And here are the four S's. I help them feel safe, right? So that's that one thing is like, I've got you, you're safe. Number two is seen. That's where I'm like, I know, buddy, it's so hard when it feels unfair and the brothers get to stay up and you have to go to bed. And when you don't get what you want, it's really hard. I know. So we really like let our kids know, and it doesn't even have to be verbal. It can really just like be pulling them to us and taking a breath and rubbing their back to let them know, like, I see you're having a hard time right now. So it's really that idea of them feeling felt and really like someone gets me. So that's the second one, safe and seen. The third one is soothed. This is where we provide comfort and nurture and help. And when our kids are physically hurt, this is easy to do. But if it looks like behavior or it looks like disrespect or it, you know, they're coming at us or it looks like a tantrum, it's much harder to do. But the part of the brain that registers physical pain is this part of the brain that's also activated when they're in emotional and physiological distress from a stress response or from a big feeling. So in that moment, our whole job is to say, so, you know, when my kid was thrashing in the bed and I was holding the boundary, I could say, I know it's so hard and I'm right here with you while you're feeling it. And I don't have to spend so much time figuring out what do I do and do I give a consequence? I don't have to worry about all that. My job is to show up in that moment with my presence and communicate to him, I can handle your big feelings. I trust that you can handle your big feelings. And when we get on the other side of this, you're going to have a little more resilience knowing I can handle big feelings like this. So we soothe them. And then when our kids, so that's always the answer, safe, seen, and soothed. Because when our kids have repeated, not perfect experiences of feeling safe, seen, and soothed, then they develop that fourth S of security. And that is where their brain wires to know that if they have a need, we're going to see it and show up for them. And then over time, they learn how to show up for themselves, how to keep themselves safe, how to see and understand themselves, how to soothe themselves, and then how to show up for other people. So to me, when we're talking about neurodiverse kids, they may need more cues of safety. They may need more feeling seen and understood. They might need more soothing, and they might need more reps of feeling like my parents got me. Like they're going to keep showing up for me when the world overwhelms me. So to me, that's my North Star, not only as a mom, but as a professional and as a wife and as a best friend and as a daughter and a sister, all of those things. We all need the four S's. But I think it's especially true for neurodiverse kids. So they may need more of the four S's. So that's my favorite way to think about that.
I love that. I think that, and I like how you say how that it can apply to not only all children, but even ourselves as in all the different roles that we have in life. So that's great. And what a great way to end the episode. I love all of the tips that you gave us today with discipline and with bedtime battles. But before we sign off, I want you to share with us, how can we find your center? How can parents work with you if they want to work with you? And then any other exciting projects and books and all of the stuff that might be coming out soon, please share with us.
Yeah. So a couple of things. I'm easy to find. My website is tinabryson.com. I've been on lots and lots of podcasts. So if you just Google me, you can find me. My favorite place, I'm on all kinds of social media, but Instagram is my favorite place right now. And I'm posting a lot of stuff there. Tina Payne Bryson is my handle there. My center is thecenterforconnection.org. And they're also on Instagram. We also have, in the last year, we opened a place called the Center for Connection and neurodiversity. So we actually have an OT-based place that's in Duarte, California. Two of our occupational therapists kind of did this as a branch out project. And it's part of the Center for Connection, but it's really focusing on supporting kids and parents where neurodiversity is part of their family. So I'm really proud of that as well. So you can find that that's at the center on Instagram. And a couple of really fun things. In fact, speaking of bedtime, this is a good one to tell you about. There's a Netflix based podcast called Bedtime Stories, and it's actually kids' favorite Netflix characters telling bedtime stories. And I got to consult on all the scripts, and they are adorable and lovely. And they really are. I worked with them to make them be episodes where kids learn some interesting things, but it's really about helping downregulate toward falling asleep. So it's a really great tool.
Ooh, and I like,
you know,
that.
Kids can listen to it after you've said goodnight as they're falling asleep on their own, but you can also listen to it with them as you're snuggling. It doesn't replace bedtime routine and it's not screens. It's an audio podcast. But that's a really fun, thing that I'm working on. And
is that out already?
It is. It just launched about a month ago. So it's called Bedtime Stories with Netflix.
Okay.
And it's just adorable. The little characters are so cute. I just think it turned out really great.
That's so fun.
Yes, and lots of projects in the works. Not ones I can say are for sure going to happen, but maybe a children's book, maybe. yeah, and I'm doing a lot of business consulting right now, which is super fun, bringing some of these ideas into corporate culture. And I'm trying to work a little less.
Doing all of those things and also work less. Sounds.
I've got one guy at home still. The other two are in college, and I'm really trying to savor these last few years. So,
well, good those for you. You've done amazing things, and I'm excited to see all of the potential new projects come out. So, thank you so much for sharing everything with us today. I hope everyone got more tips for bedtime, maybe something you haven't heard yet, maybe just validation that you're already doing the right thing, which is what a lot of parents need to hear more of. And thank you for helping me celebrate Occupational Therapy Month.
I'm a big fan.
Yes, we love it. Thank you everyone for listening, and I'll see you guys next week. Take care.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider rating it and leaving a review, which helps other parents find me as well. Want to learn more from me? I share tons more over on Instagram @TheOTButterfly. See you next time.